The Cat Who Could Read Backwards, Disc 3.
Chapter 7. "I have a complaint," Quillerin told Arch at the press club on Wednesday night. "I know what it is. Your name was spelled with a U yesterday, but we caught it in the second edition. You know what's going to happen, don't you? The next time the typographers' union meets with management, the spelling of your name is going to be one of their grievances. I have another beef, too. I wasn't hired to be an orderly for your art critic, but that's what he seems to think. Do you know he's leaving town tonight?"
"I guessed as much," said Arch. "That last batch of tapes included enough copy for 3 columns.
First, I delivered those tapes for him, and then I picked up his ticket for the 3 o'clock plane this afternoon. And now I'm expected to do latrine duty for his cat. Wait till Odd Bunsen hears this. Don't tell him. Nosy Bunsen will find out soon enough in his own devious way. I'm supposed to feed the cat twice a day, change his drinking water, and attend to his commode. Do you know what a commode is?"
"I can guess.
It was new to me. I thought cats just ran out in the backyard."
"There's nothing in the guild contract about reporters doing toity service," Arch said. "Why didn't you decline?"
"Mount Clemens didn't give me a chance. He's a sly operator. There I was, sitting in his kitchen, mesmerized by fresh pineapple, broiled chicken livers and eggs and sour cream. It was female pineapple, what's more. What could I do?"
"You'll have to choose between pride and gluttony, that's all. Don't you like cats?"
"Sure, I like animals, and this cat is more human than a few people I could name. But he gives me the uncomfortable feeling that he knows more than I do, and he's not telling what it is."
Arch said, "We have cats around the house all the time. The kids bring them home. But none of them ever gave me an inferiority complex."
"Your kids never brought home a Siamese."
"You can stand it for 3 or 4 days. If it gets too much for you, we'll send a copy boy with a master's degree. He should be able to cope with a Siamese."
"Knock it off. Here comes Odd Bunsen," said Quillerin. Even before the photographer appeared, the cigar could be detected and the voice could be heard, complaining about the frigid temperature outside. Odd tapped Quillerin on the shoulder.
"Are those cat hairs on your lapel, or have you been dating a blonde with a crew cut?"
Quillerin combed his mustache with a swizzle stick.
Odd said, "I'm still on nights. Any of you guys want to eat with me? I've got an hour for dinner, if nobody blows up City Hall."
"I'll eat with you," said Quillerin.
They found a table and consulted the menu. Odd ordered Salisbury steak, complimented the waitress on the trimness of her waistline, and then said to Quillerin,
"Well, have you got old Monty figured out yet? If I went around insulting everybody the way he does, I'd get fired. Or assigned to society, what's worse. How does he get away with it?"
"Critic's license. Besides, newspapers like controversial writers."
"And where does he get all his money? I hear he lives pretty well, travels a lot, drives an expensive car. He doesn't do that on what the Flux pays him."
"Mount Clemens doesn't drive," Quillerin said.
"Sure he does. I've seen him behind the wheel. I saw him this morning."
"He told me he didn't have a car. He rides taxis."
"Maybe he doesn't own one, but he drives one sometimes."
"How do you suppose he manages?"
"No sweat, automatic transmission. Didn't you ever do any one-arm driving? You must be a lousy lover. I used to drive with one arm, shift gears, and eat a hot dog all at the same time."
"I've got a few questions, too," Quillerin said. "Are the local artists as bad as Mount Clemens says? Or is he as phony as the artists think? Mount Clemens says Halape is a charlatan. Halape says Zoe Lambert's paintings are a hoax. Zoe says Sandy Halape is uninformed. Sandy says Mount Clemens is irresponsible. Mount Clemens says Farhar is incompetent. Farhar says Mount Clemens knows nothing about art. Mount Clemens says Earl Lambert is pathetic. Lambert says Mount Clemens is a monument of taste, truth, and integrity. So who's on first?"
"Listen," said Odd. "I think they're paging me."
The voice, mumbling over the public address system, could hardly be heard above the hubbub in the bar.
"Yep, that's for me," the photographer said. "Somebody must have blown up the City Hall."
He went to the telephone, and Quillerin pondered the complexities of the art beat. When Odd Bunsen returned from the telephone booth, he was taut with excitement. Quillerin thought, a press photographer for 15 years, and he still lights up when there's a 3-alarm fire.
"I've got news for you," said Odd, leaning over the table and keeping his voice down.
"What is it?"
"Trouble on your beat."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Homicide. I'm on my way to the Lambreth Gallery."
"The Lambreth?" Quillerin stood up fast enough to knock over his chair. Who is it? Not Zoe.
No, her husband.
Know what happened?
They said he was stabbed. Want to come with me?
I told the desk you were here, and they said it would be good if you could cover it. Kendall's out on a story, and both leg men are busy.
Okay, I'll go.
Better phone them back and say so. I've got my car outside.
When Quillerin and Bunsen arrived in front of the Lambeth Gallery, there was an unwarranted calm in the street. The financial district was normally deserted after 5:30, and even a murder had failed to draw much of a crowd. A sharp wind whipped down the canyon created by nearby office buildings, and only a few shivering stragglers stood about on the sidewalk, but they soon moved on. A loneliness filled the street. Isolated voices sounded unreasonably loud. The newsmen identified themselves to the patrolman at the door. Inside, the expensive art and plush furnishings made an unlikely background for the assortment of uninvited guests. A police photographer was taking pictures of some paintings that had been viciously slashed. Bunsen pointed out the precinct inspector and Hames, a detective from the Homicide Bureau. Hames nodded at them and jerked a thumb upstairs. The newsmen started up the spiral staircase at the rear and then backed away to let a fingerprint man come down. He was talking to himself. He was saying, "How can they get a stretcher down this thing? They'll have to take him out the window." Upstairs, a sharp voice was saying, "Come on, you fellows. You can take care of that downstairs. Let's thin out."
"That's Wojcik from Homicide," said Bunsen. "No fooling around with him."
The framing shop was approximately as Quillerin remembered it, except for the men with badges, cameras, and notebooks. A patrolman stood in the doorway to Lambeth's office, facing out. Over his shoulder, Quillerin could see that the office had been fairly well wrecked. The body lay on the floor near the desk. He got Wojcik's attention and flipped open a small notebook.
"Murderer known?"
"No,"
said the detective.
"Victim Earl Lambeth, director of the gallery?"
"Right."
"Method?"
"Stabbed with a tool from the workbench, a sharp chisel."
"Where?"
"Throat, a very wet job."
"Body discovered where?"
"In his office."
"By whom?"
"Victim's wife, Zoe."
Quillerin took a second to gulp and grimace.
"That's spelled Z-O-E," said the detective.
"I know." "Any sign of a struggle?"
"Office practically turned upside down."
"What about the vandalism in the gallery?"
"Several pictures damaged, a statue broken. You can see that downstairs."
"What time did it happen?"
"The electric clock knocked off the desk stopped at 6:15.
"The gallery was closed at that time."
"Right."
"Any evidence of forcible breaking and entering?"
"Nope."
"Then the murderer could have been someone who had legitimate access to the place."
"Could be. We found the front door locked. The alley door may or may not have been locked when Mrs. Lambeth arrived."
"Anything stolen?"
"Not immediately apparent."
Wojcik started to move away.
"That's all. You've got the story. One more question. Any suspects?"
"No."
Downstairs, while Bunsen scrambled around taking pictures, Quillerin studied the nature of the vandalism. Two oil paintings had been ripped diagonally by a sharp instrument. A framed picture lay on the floor with its glass broken as if a heel had been put through it. A reddish clay sculpture appeared to have been bounced off a marble-top table. There were scattered fragments. Paintings by Zoe Lambeth and Scrano, the only two names that registered with Quillerin, were unharmed. He remembered the sculpture from his previous visit. The elongated shape with random swellings had apparently been a woman's figure. Its label, still affixed to the empty pedestal, said, "Eve by B.H. Riggs, Terracotta." The watercolor on the floor was one Quillerin had not noticed the week before. It resembled a jigsaw puzzle of many colors, just a pleasing pattern. It was titled Interior, and the artist's name was Mary Orr. The label called it a gouache. Then Quillerin examined the two oils. Both were composed of wavy vertical stripes of color applied on a white background with a wide brush. The colors were violent, red, purple, orange, pink, and the paintings seemed to vibrate like a plucked string. Quillerin wondered who would buy these nerve-wracking works of art. He preferred his second-rate Monet. Stepping closer to check the labels, he noted that one was Beach Scene No. 3 by Milton Orr, Oil, while the other was Beach Scene No. 2 by the same artist.
In a way, the titles were a help in appreciating the pictures. They began to remind Quillerin of shimmering heat waves rising from hot sand. He said to Bunsen, "Look at these two pictures. Would you say they were beach scenes?"
"I'd say the artist was drunk," said Odd.
Quillerin moved back a few paces and squinted at the two oils. Suddenly he saw a crowd of standing figures. He had been looking at the red, orange, and purple stripes, and he should have been seeing the white voids between them. The vertical stripes of white suggested the contours of female bodies, abstract but recognizable. He thought, women's figures in those white stripes. A woman's torso in the broken clay. Let's have another look at the watercolor. When he knew what he was searching for, it was not hard to find. In the jagged wedges of color that made up the pattern of Mary Orr's work, he could distinguish a window, a chair, a bed, on which reclined a human figure. Female. He said to Odd Bunsen, "I'd like to go out to the Lambeth house and see if Zoe will talk to me. Also, she might have a photograph of the deceased. Shall we check with the desk?" After phoning the details to a rewrite man and getting a go-ahead from the city desk, Quillerin folded himself into Odd Bunsen's cramped two-seater, and they drove to 3434 Sampler Street. The Lambeth home was a contemporary townhouse in a new neighborhood, self-consciously well-designed, that had replaced a former slum. The newsmen rang the doorbell and waited. Draperies were drawn to cover the large windows, but it could be seen that lights were burning in every room, upstairs and downstairs. They rang the bell again. When the door opened, the trousered woman who stood there, arms folded belligerently, feet planted solidly on the threshold, looked familiar to Quillerin. She was tall and husky. Her soft face was set in a stern expression. "Yes," she said defiantly. "I'm a friend of Mrs. Lambreth," said Quillerin. "I wonder if I could see her and offer my assistance. Jim Quillerin's the name. This is Mr. Bunsen." "You're from the paper. She's not going to see any reporters tonight."
"This isn't an official visit. We were on our way home and thought there might be something we could do. Aren't you Miss Bolton?"
Inside the house, a low, tired voice called,
"Who is it, Butchie?"
"Quillerin and another man from the Fluxion."
"It's all right. Ask them in."
The newsmen stepped into a room furnished in stark contemporary style. The furnishings were few but fine, and there, leaning against a door jamb, was Zoe Lambreth wearing purple silk trousers and a lavender blouse, and looking gaunt and bewildered. Butchie said,
"She should be lying down and resting."
Zoe said, "I'm all right. I'm too keyed up to do any resting."
"She wouldn't take a sedative."
"Will you gentlemen sit down?" Zoe said. Quillerin's face reflected the sympathetic understanding for which he was famous. Even his mustache contributed to the expression of grave concern. He said, "I don't need to tell you my feelings. Even though our acquaintance was short, I feel a personal loss."
"It's terrible. Just terrible."
Zoe sat on the extreme edge of the sofa with her hands folded on her knees. "I visited the gallery last week, as you suggested."
"I know, Earl told me."
"It's impossible to imagine what a shock this must have been."
Butchie interrupted.
"I don't think she should be talking about it."
"Butchie, I've got to talk about it," said Zoe, "or I'll go crazy." She looked at Quillerin with the full brown eyes that he remembered so well from their first meeting, and now they reminded him of the eyes in Zoe's own paintings at the gallery. He said, "Was it your custom to go to the gallery after it was closed?"
"Quite the contrary. I seldom went there at any time. It looks unprofessional for an artist to hang around the gallery that handles her work, especially in our case, husband and wife. It would look too folksy."
"The gallery impressed me as very sophisticated," Quillerin said. "Very suitable for the financial district."
Butchie said, with a frank show of pride,
"That was Zoe's idea."
"Mrs. Lambreth, what caused you to go to the gallery tonight?"
"I was there twice. The first time was just before closing time. I had been shopping all afternoon and stopped in to see if Earl wanted to stay downtown for dinner. He said he couldn't leave until 7 o'clock or later."
"What time was it when you were talking to him?"
"The front door was still open, so it must have been before 5:30.
"Did he explain why he couldn't leave the gallery?"
"He had to work on the books. for a tax deadline or something, so I went home. But I was tired and didn't feel like cooking. Butchie said, she's been working night and day getting ready for a one-man show. So I decided to have a bath and change clothes, Zoe went on, and go back downtown at 7 o'clock and drag Earl away from his books.
Did you telephone him to say you were returning to the gallery?
I think so, or maybe I didn't. I can't remember. I thought about phoning, but in the rush of getting dressed, I don't know whether I called or not. You know how it is. You do things automatically without thinking. Sometimes I can't remember whether I've brushed my teeth, and I have to look at the toothbrush to see if it's wet.
When did you arrive at the gallery the second time?
Just about 7 o'clock, I think. Earl had taken the car in for repairs, so I called a taxi and had the driver take me to the alley entrance of the gallery. I have a key for the back door, just in case of emergency.
It was locked?
That's another thing I don't remember. It should have been locked. I put my key in the lock and turned the door handle without thinking much about it. The door opened and I went in.
Did you notice anything amiss on the ground floor?
No. The lights were out. I went right up the spiral staircase. As soon as I walked into the workroom, I sensed something wrong. It was deadly quiet. I was almost afraid to go into the office.
She was remembering it painfully.
But I did. First I saw papers and everything all over the floor, and then...
She put her face in her hands, and there was silence in the room.
After a while, Quillerin said gently, "Would you like me to notify Mount Clemens in New York? I know he thought highly of you both."
"If you wish."
"Have the funeral plans been made?"
Butchie said, "There won't be a funeral. Zoe doesn't approve of funerals."
Quillerin stood up. "We'll be going now, but please let me know, Mrs. Lambert, if there's anything I can do. Sometimes it helps just to talk."
Butchie said, "I'm here. I'm looking after her."
Quillerin thought the woman sounded possessive. He said, "Just one more thing, Mrs. Lambert. Do you have a good photograph of your husband?"
"No. Just a portrait I painted last year. It's in my studio. Butchie will show you. I think I'll go upstairs."
She walked from the room without further ceremony, and Butchie led the newsmen to the studio at the rear of the house. There on the wall was Earl Lambert, cold, haughty, supercilious, painted without love.
"Perfect likeness," said Butchie with pride. "She really captured his personality."
Almost inaudible was the click of Odd Bunsen's camera. Chapter 8. When Quillerin and Odd Bunsen drove away from the Lambert house, they shivered in silence until the heater in Odd's car gave out the first promising puff. Then Odd said,
"The Lamberths seem to be doing all right at that art racket. Wish I could live like that. I'll bet that sofa is worth $1,000. Who was that big bruiser?"
"Butchie Bolton, teaches sculpture at Penniman School of Fine Art."
"She really thought she was running the show. Enjoying it, too."
Quillerin agreed.
Butchie didn't strike me as being exactly grief-stricken over the loss of Earl Lambert. I wonder where she fits into the picture. Friend of the family, I suppose.
"If you ask me," said Odd, "I don't think that doll Zoe was taking it too hard either."
"She's a calm, intelligent woman," Quillerin said, "even if she is a doll. She's not the type to collapse."
"If my wife ever finds me lying in a pool of blood, I want her to collapse, and collapse good. I don't want her running home and fixing her lipstick and putting on a sharp outfit to receive callers. Imagine a dame not remembering whether she telephoned her husband or not, and not remembering whether the gallery door was locked."
"It was the shock. It leaves blanks in the memory. She'll remember tomorrow, or the next day. What did you think of the portrait she painted of her husband?"
"Perfect. He's a cold fish. I couldn't have taken a photograph that was any better."
Quillerin said, "I used to think these modern artists painted drips and blots because they couldn't draw. But now I'm not so sure. Zoe is really talented."
"If she's so talented, why does she waste her time painting that modern garbage?"
"Probably because it sells. By the way, I'd like to meet our police reporter."
"Lodge Kendall? Haven't you met him yet? He's over at the press club just about every day for lunch."
"I'd like to have a talk with him."
"Want me to line it up for tomorrow?"
Odd said. "Okay. Where are you headed now?"
"Back to the lab."
"If it isn't out of your way, would you drop me at my apartment?"
"No sweat."
Quillerin looked at his wristwatch and the glow from the instrument panel.
"It's 10:30," he said, "and I forgot to feed the cat."
"Uh-huh," said Odd. "I told you Monty wanted you for a cat sitter."
A few minutes later, when he turned the car into Blenheim Place, he said, "Doesn't this neighborhood scare the hell out of you? The characters you see on the streets."
"They don't bother me," said Quillerin. "You wouldn't get me to live here. I'm a coward."
A folded newspaper lay on the porch of number 26. Quillerin picked it up, unlocked the front door, and closed it quickly behind him, glad to get in out of the cold. He rattled the door handle to make sure it was locked again, as Mount Clemens had warned him to do. Using a second key, he unlocked the inner vestibule door, and that's when he recoiled in black fright. Out of the dark came a wild scream. Quillerin's mind went blank. The hairs of his mustache stood on end. His heart pounded. Instinctively, he gripped the newspaper like a club. Then he realized the source of the scream. Coco was waiting for him. Coco was scolding him. Coco was hungry. Coco was furious. Quillerin leaned against the door jamb and gasped. He loosened his tie.
"Never do that again," he told the cat.
Coco was sitting on the table that was supported by golden lions, and he retorted with a torrent of abuse.
"All right, all right," Quillerin yelled at him. "I apologize, I forgot, that's all. Important business downtown."
Coco continued his tirade.
"Wait till I take my coat off, will you?"
Once Quillerin started upstairs, the tumult ceased. The cat bounded ahead and led him into Mount Clemens's apartment, which was in darkness. Quillerin groped for a light switch. This delay irritated Coco, who commenced another vocal demonstration. Now the piercing cries had gravel-throated undertones signifying menace.
I'm coming," said Quillerin, following the cat down the long, narrow hall to the kitchen.
Coco led him directly to the refrigerator, where there was a chunk of beef waiting in a glass tray. It looked like a whole tenderloin. Quillerin put the meat on a built-in butcher's block and hunted for a sharp knife.
"Where does he keep his knives?" he said, pulling open one drawer after another.
Coco leaped lightly to the adjoining counter and nosed a knife rack where five handsome blades hung point downward on a magnetized bar.
"Thanks," said Quillerin.
He started to carve the beef, marveling at the quality of the cutlery. Real chef's knives. They made meat cutting a pleasure. How did Mount Clemens say to cut the beef? The size of a kidney bean or the size of a navy bean? And how about the broth? He said to warm it in broth. Where was the broth? The cat was sitting on the counter, supervising every move with what appeared to be an impatient scowl. Quillerin said,
"How about eating it raw, old man, since it's so late?"
Coco gargled a low note in his throat, which Quillerin assumed was acquiescence. In a cupboard he found a plate, white porcelain with a wide gold band. He arranged the meat on it, attractively, he thought, and placed it on the floor alongside a ceramic water bowl decorated with the word cat in three languages. Coco jumped to the floor with a grunt, walked to the plate, and examined the beef. Then he looked up at Quillerin with incredulity displayed in the tilt of his ears.
"Go ahead, eat," said Quillerin. "Enjoy it in good health."
Coco lowered his head once more. He sniffed. He touched the beef with his paw and gave a perceptible shudder. He shook his paw fastidiously and walked away, his tail pointed stiffly toward the North Star. Later, after Quillerin had found some thin gravy in the refrigerator and prepared the meal properly, Cao Ko Kung consented to dine. The newsman related the experience at the press club the following noon when he had lunch with Arch Riker and Lodge Kendall. "But this morning I acquitted myself admirably," said Quillerin. "Coco got me up at 6:30 by yelling outside my door, and I went up and prepared breakfast to his satisfaction. I think he's going to let me keep the job until Mount Clemens comes home." The police reporter was young, tense, earnest, literal, and unsmiling. He said,
"Do you mean to say you let a cat boss you around?"
"Actually, I feel sorry for him. Poor little rich cat. Nothing but tenderloin and pâté de la maison. I wish I could catch him a mouse." Arch explained to Kendall,
"You see, this is a Siamese descended from an Egyptian god. It not only communicates and runs the show, it reads newspaper headlines. A cat that can read is obviously superior to a newspaper man who can't catch mice."
Quillerin said, "He flies, too. When he wants to get to the top of an 8-foot bookcase, he just puts his ears back and zooms up like a jet, no wings. He's got some kind of
aerodynamic principle that ordinary cats don't have. Kendall regarded the two older men with wonder and suspicion. After Coco got me up at 6:30, said Quillerin, I started thinking about the Lambreth murder. Any developments, Lodge?
Nothing released this morning.
Have they reached any conclusions about the vandalism?
Not that I've heard.
Well, I observed something last night that looks interesting. All four items that were damaged were portrayals of the female figure more or less unclothed. Did the police notice that?
I don't know, said the police reporter. I'll mention it at headquarters.
It isn't easy to spot. The stuff is pretty abstract, and a casual glance wouldn't tell anything.
Then the vandal must have been someone who digs modern art, said Kendall. Some kind of nut who hated his mother.
That narrows it down, said Arch. Quillerin was in his element, on the fringe of the police beat where he had learned the newspaper craft. His face had a glow, even his mustache looked happy. Three corned beef sandwiches came to the table with a plastic squeeze bottle, and the newsmen concentrated on applying mustard, each in his fashion. Arch squirting it on the rye bread in concentric circles, Kendall limning a precise zigzag, and Quillerin squeezing out a reckless abstraction. After a while, Kendall said to him,
"Know much about Lambreth?"
"I just met him once. He was sort of a stuffed shirt."
"Was the gallery successful?"
"Hard to say. It was sumptuously furnished. But that doesn't prove anything. Some of the paintings were priced in five figures, although I wouldn't give you 5 cents for them. I imagine investors were buying this kind of art. That's why Lambreth set up shop in the financial district."
"Maybe some sucker thought he'd been taken and got into a fatal argument with the dealer."
"That doesn't fit in with the nature of the vandalism." Arch said,
"Do you think the choice of weapon indicates anything?"
"It was a chisel from the workbench," said Kendall.
"Either the killer seized on that in a moment of passion, or he knew in advance it would be there for the purpose." "Who was employed in the workroom?"
"I don't think anyone was employed," said Quillerin. "I suspect Lambreth made the frames himself, in spite of the fancy front he put on for customers. When I was there, I noticed definite evidence of work in progress, but no workmen. And when I asked who made the frames, he gave me an evasive answer. Then I noticed that his hands were grimy, you know, stained and battered as if he did manual labor."
"Then maybe the gallery wasn't too successful, and he was cutting corners."
"On the other hand, he was living in a good neighborhood, and his house appeared to be furnished expensively."
Kendall said, "I wonder if Lambreth admitted the killer to the premises after hours, or did the killer let himself in the back way with a key?"
"I'm sure it was someone Lambreth knew," Quillerin said, "and I think the evidence of a struggle was rigged after the murder."
"How do you figure that?"
"From the position of the body. Lambreth seemed to have gone down between his swivel chair and his desk, as if he had been sitting there when the murderer took him by surprise. He wouldn't engage in a brawl and then go and sit at his desk waiting to be polished off."
"Well, let the police solve it," said Arch. "We've got work to do."
As the men left the lunch table, the bartender beckoned to Quillerin.
"I read about the Lambreth murder," he said, and paused significantly before adding, "I know that gallery."
"You do? What do you know about it?"
"Lambreth was a crook."
"What makes you think so?"
Bruno gave a hasty glance up and down the bar.
"I know a lot of painters and sculptors, and any one of them can tell you how Lambreth operated. He'd sell something for $800 and give the artist a measly $150.
"You think one of your pals wiped him out?" Bruno was suitably indignant.
"I wasn't saying anything like that. I just thought you'd like to know what kind of a guy he was."
"Well, thanks.
And his wife isn't much better."
"What do you mean by that?" The bartender picked up a towel and wiped the bar where it didn't need wiping.
"Everybody knows she's been playing around. You've got to hand it to her, though. She tiddlywinks where it'll do the most good."
"Like where?"
"Like upstairs, over where you live. I understand it's quite a cozy apartment up there."
Bruno stopped wiping the bar and gave Quillerin a significant look.
"She goes up there to paint the cat."
Quillerin shrugged a no comment and started to leave. Bruno called him back.
"Something else too, Mr. Quillerin," he said.
"I heard about some funny business at the museum. There's a valuable art object missing, and they're hushing it up."
"Why would they hush it up?"
"Who knows? A lot of funny things go on at that place."
"What's missing?"
"A dagger from the Florentine room. This friend of mine, he's a guard at the museum. He discovered the dagger was missing and reported it, but nobody wants to do anything about it. I thought it might be a scoop for you.
Thanks. I'll look into it, said Quillerin.
Some of his best tips had come from press club bartenders. Also, some of the worst. On the way out of the building, he stopped in the lobby where the ladies of the press were running a benefit sale of secondhand books. For a half dollar, he picked up a copy of Keeping Your Pet Happy. He also bought A Study of Crests and Troughs in American Business from 1800 to 1850 for a dime. Back at the office, he telephoned the Lambreth home. Butchie answered and said no, Zoe couldn't come to the phone. Yes, she had managed to get some sleep. No, there was nothing Quillerin could do. He finished his afternoon's work and went home with his coat collar turned up against the snow that had started to fall. He thought he would feed the cat, go out and grab a hamburger somewhere, and then wander over to the art museum to look at the Florentine room. It was Thursday, and the museum was open late. When he arrived at number 26, shaking the snow from his shoulders and stamping his feet, he found Coco waiting for him. The cat greeted him in the front hall, not with a noisy bill of complaints this time, but an appreciative squeak. The way his whiskers tilted upward gave him a pleasant look of expectancy. The newsman felt flattered. "Hello, old fellow," he said. "Did you have an eventful day?" From Coco's noncommittal murmur, Quillerin decided the cat's day had been somewhat less interesting than his own. He started upstairs to carve the tenderloin, or whatever one called the cut of beef that Mount Clemens supplied for cat food, and noted that Coco did not bound ahead of him. Instead, the cat was dogging his heels and getting between his ankles as he climbed the stairs. "What are you trying to do, trip me?" Quillerin said. He prepared the beef according to official instructions, placed the dish on the floor, and sat down to watch Coco eat. He was beginning to appreciate the fine points of Siamese design— the elegant proportions of the body, the undulating muscles beneath the fine coat, and the exquisite shading of the fur from off-white to pale fawn to the darkest of velvety browns. Quillerin decided it was the finest shade of brown he had ever seen. To his surprise, the cat showed no interest in food. He wanted to rub ankles and utter plaintive, high-pitched mews. "What's the matter with you?" said Quillerin. "You're a hard one to figure out." The cat looked up with a beseeching expression in his blue eyes, purred loudly, and raised one paw to Quillerin's knee. "Coco, I'll bet you're lonesome. You're used to having someone around all day. Are you feeling neglected?" He lifted the willing bundle of warm fur to his shoulder, and Coco purred in his ear with a rasping undertone that denoted extreme satisfaction. "I think I'll stay home tonight," Quillerin told the cat. "Weather's bad. Snow's getting deep. Left my rubbers at the office." Scrounging for something to eat, he helped himself to a slice of Coco's pâté de la maison. It was the best meatloaf he had ever tasted. Coco sensed that this was a party and began to race from one end of the apartment to the other. He seemed to be flying low over the carpet, his feet moving but never touching the floor, up over the desk in a single leap, then from chair to bookshelf to table to another chair to cabinet top, all with bewildering speed. Quillerin began to realize why there were no table lamps in the apartment. He too wandered around at a more leisurely rate. He opened a door in the long, narrow hall and found a bedroom with a four-poster bed that had red velvet side curtains and a canopy. In the bathroom, he found a green flask labeled Essence of Lime. He took a sniff and recognized the scent. In the living room, he strolled with his hands in his pants pockets, enjoying a close inspection of Mount Clemens's treasures. Engraved brass labels on the picture frames said Hals, Gauguin, Aikens. So this was a love nest, according to Bruno. Quillerin had to agree it was well equipped for the purpose. Dim lights, soft music, candles, wine, big loungy chairs, everything to induce a mellow mood. And now Earl Lambreth was dead. Quillerin blew through his mustache as he considered the possibilities. It was not difficult to visualize Mount Clemens as a wife-stealer. The critic had a suave charm that would appeal to any woman he chose to impress, and an authority that would never take no for an answer. Wife-stealer, yes. Murderer, no. Mount Clemens was too elegant, too fastidious for that. Eventually, Quillerin returned to his own apartment, followed by a genial Coco. For the cat's amusement, Quillerin tied a wad of folded paper to a length of string and dangled it. At 9 o'clock, the final edition of the Daily Fluxion was delivered, and Coco perused the headlines. When the newsman finally settled down in an easy chair with a book, the cat took possession of his lap, the silky fur testifying to a state of contentment. It was with apparent reluctance that Coco took leave at midnight and went upstairs to his cushion on top of the refrigerator. Quillerin described his evening of cat-sitting the next day when he stopped at Art Riker's desk to pick up his paycheck. Art said, "How are you hitting it off with the critic's cat?" "Coco was lonesome last night, so I stayed home and entertained him. We played Sparrow." "Is this some parlor game I'm not familiar with?" "It's something we invented, like tennis with one player and no net," said Quillerin. "I make a sparrow out of paper and tie it to a piece of string. Then I swing it back and forth while Coco bats it with his paw. He's got a substantial backhand, I want you to know. Every time he connects, he gets 1 point. If he strikes and misses, that's a point for me. 21 points is game. I'm keeping a running score. After 5 games last night, it was Coco 108 and Quillerin 92. "I'm betting on the cat all the way," said Arch. He reached for a sheet of pink paper. "I know that cat consumes a lot of your time, attention, and physical strength, but I wish you'd give me some action on that Halapay profile. Another pink memo came up this morning."
"I'll be all set as soon as I have one more meeting with Mrs. Halapay," said Quillerin. Returning to his desk, he called Sandy and suggested lunch the following Wednesday.
"Let's make it for dinner," she suggested. "Cal is in Denmark, and I'm all alone. I'd love to go to dinner where there's a dance band. You're such a wonderful dancer."
Her laughter left the sincerity of her compliment in doubt. "Be nice to people," said the slogan on his telephone, and he replied, "Sandy, I'd enjoy that very much, but not next week. I'll be working nights." The telephone said nothing about lying to people. "Let's just have lunch on Wednesday and discuss your husband's charities and civic activities. They've given me a firm deadline on this profile."
"All right," she said. "I'll pick you up and we'll drive out somewhere. We'll have scads to talk about. I want to hear all about the Lambreth murder."
"I'm afraid I don't know much about it."
"Why, I think it's all perfectly obvious."
"What's obvious?"
"That it's a family affair."
Waited pause.
"You know what was going on, don't you?"
"No, I don't."
"Well, I wouldn't want to discuss it on the phone," she said. "See you Wednesday at noon."
Quillerin spent the morning finishing up odds and ends. He wrote a short humorous piece about a local graphics artist who had switched to watercolors after dropping a 100-pound lithograph stone on his foot. Then he did an inspirational story about a prize-winning textile weaver who was also a high school math teacher, author of 2 published novels, licensed pilot, cellist, and mother of 10. Next, he considered the talented poodle who Paul painted pictures. The poodle was having a show at the Humane Society shelter. Just as Quillerin was visualizing the headline, "One Dog Exhibition of Poodle Doodles," the telephone on his desk rang. He answered, and a low, breathy voice gave him a ripple of pleasure.
"This is Zoe Lambreth, Mr. Quillerin. I must speak softly. Can you hear me?"
"Yes. Is anything wrong?"
"I need to talk with you in person, if you can spare the time. Not here, downtown."
"Would the press club be all right?"
"Is there some place more private? I'd like to talk confidentially."
"Would you mind coming to my apartment?"
"That would be better. You live in Mount Clemens's building, don't you?"
"Number 26 Blenheim Place."
"I know where it is."
"How about tomorrow afternoon? Take a taxi. It isn't a nice neighborhood."
"Tomorrow. Thank you so much. I need your advice. I must hang up now."
There was an abrupt click, and the voice was gone. Quillerin's mustache virtually danced. "Widow of slain art dealer, reveals story to Flux reporter." Chapter 9. It had been a long time since Quillerin had entertained a woman in his apartment, and he waked Saturday morning with a mild case of stage fright. He swallowed a cup of instant coffee, gnawed on a stale donut, and wondered if he should serve Zoe something to eat or drink. coffee seemed suitable under the circumstances. Coffee and what? Donuts would look frivolous. Why, he couldn't explain. Cake? Too pretentious. Cookies? There was a grocery in the neighborhood that specialized in beer, cheap wine, and gummy white bread. Dubiously, Quillerin inspected their packaged cookies, but the ingredients listed in small type, artificial flavoring, emulsifier, glycerin, lecithin, and invert syrup, dampened his interest. He inquired for a bakery and walked 6 blocks through February slush to a shop where the merchandise appeared edible. Vetoing petty fours, too fancy, and oatmeal cookies, too hearty, he settled on chocolate chip cookies and bought 2 pounds. There was an old-fashioned percolator in his kitchenette, but how it operated was a mystery to him. Zoe would have to accept instant coffee. He wondered if she used sugar and cream. Back he went to the grocery store for 1 pound of sugar, 1/2 pint of coffee cream, and some paper napkins. By that time it was noon, and a reluctant February sun began slanting into the apartment, exposing dust on the tables, lint on the rug, and cat hair on the sofa. Quillerin dusted with paper napkins, then hurried upstairs to Mount Clemens's apartment to hunt for a vacuum cleaner. He found one in a broom closet in the kitchen. 1 o'clock came, and he was ready. Except for cigarettes. He had forgotten cigarettes. He rushed out to the drugstore and bought something long, mild, and unfiltered. After debating about the filter, he decided Zoe was not one to compromise. At 1:30, he lighted the gas logs in the fireplace and sat down to wait. Zoe arrived promptly at 4. Quillerin saw a lovely woman in a soft brown fur coat step from a taxi, look up and down the street, and hurry up to the portico. He was there to meet her.
"Thank you so much for letting me come," she said in a low-pitched, breathless voice. "Butchie has been watching me like a hawk, and I had to sneak out of the house. I shouldn't complain. At a time like this, you need a friend like Butchie."
She dropped her brown alligator handbag.
"I'm sorry. I'm very much upset."
"Just take it easy," said Quillerin, "and gather yourself together. Would a cup of coffee feel good?"
"I'd better not have coffee," she said. "It makes me nervous, and I'm jumpy enough as it is."
She gave Quillerin her coat and took a seat in a straight-backed pull-up chair, crossing her knees attractively.
"Do you mind if we close the door?"
"Not at all, although there's no one else in the house."
"I had an uneasy feeling I was being followed. I took a cab to the arcade building, then walked through and picked up another one at the other entrance. Do you think they might have someone following me? The police, I mean."
"I don't see why they should." "What gave you that idea?"
"They came to the house yesterday, 2 of them. 2 detectives. They were perfect gentlemen, but some of their questions were upsetting, as if they were trying to trap me. Do you suppose they suspect me?"
"Not really. But they have to cover every possibility."
"Butchie was there, of course, and she was quite antagonistic toward the detectives. It didn't look good at all. She's so protective, you know. Altogether, it was a terrible experience."
"What did they say when they left?"
"They thanked me for my cooperation and said they might want to talk to me again. After that, I telephoned you while Butchie was down in the basement. I didn't want her to know."
"Why not?"
"Well, because she's so sure she can handle everything herself in this crisis, and also because of what I'm going to tell you. You don't suppose the police would be watching my movements, do you? Maybe I shouldn't have come here."
"Why shouldn't you come here, Mrs. Lambreth? I'm a friend of the family, I'm professionally connected with the art field, and I'm going to help you with details concerning the gallery. How does that sound?"
She smiled bleakly. "I'm beginning to feel like a criminal. One has to be so careful in talking to the police. If you use the wrong word or put the wrong inflection in your voice, they pounce on it."
"Well, now," said Quillerin in his most soothing way, "put that episode out of your mind and relax. Would you like a more comfortable chair?"
"This is fine. I have a better command of myself when I sit up straight."
She was wearing a pale blue dress of fuzzy wool that made her look soft and fragile. Quillerin tried not to stare at the provocative indentation just below her kneecap. He said, "I find this a very comfortable apartment. My landlord has a knack for furnishing a place. How did you know I was staying here?"
"Oh, things get around in art circles."
"Apparently you've been to this house before."
"Mount Clemens had us to dinner once or twice."
"You must know him better than most artists do."
"We've been fairly friendly. I did several studies of his cat." Did you notify him about the...
I haven't been able to find out where he stays in New York. Do you know his hotel?
It's near the Museum of Modern Art, but I can't remember the name.
She was twisting the handle of her handbag that lay on her lap. Quillerin brought a plate from the kitchenette.
Would you care for some cookies?
No, thanks. I have to count calories.
Her voice trailed away. He sensed her preoccupation and said,
Now, what is it that you want to tell me?
With the other half of his mind, he was taking Zoe's measurements and wondering why she worried about calories.
I don't know how to begin.
How about a cigarette? I'm forgetting my manners.
I gave them up a few months ago.
Mind if I light my pipe?
Abruptly, Zoe said,
I didn't tell the police everything.
No?
It may have been wrong, but I couldn't bring myself to answer some of their questions.
What kind of questions?
They asked if Earl had any enemies. How could I point a finger at someone and say he was an enemy? What would happen if I started naming people all over the city? Acquaintances, fellow club members, important people? I think that was a terrible thing to ask, don't you?
It was a necessary question.
In fact, said Quillerin in a kind but firm way, I'm going to ask you the same question. Did he have many enemies?
I'm afraid so. A lot of people disliked him. Mr. Quillerin, it's all right to talk confidentially to you, isn't it? I must confide in someone. I'm sure you're not one of those sneaky reporters who would...
Those characters are only in the movies, he assured her. His attitude was all sympathy and interest.
Zoe sighed heavily and began.
There's a lot of competition and jealousy in the art field. I don't know why it should be.
That's true in all fields.
It's worse among artists, believe me.
Could you be more specific?
Well, the gallery directors, for example. The other galleries in town felt that Earl was luring their best artists away from them.
Was he?
Zoe bristled slightly.
Naturally, the artists wanted to be represented by the foremost gallery. As a result, Earl showed better work and the Lambreth exhibitions got better reviews.
And the jealousy increased.
Zoe nodded.
Besides, Earl often had to reject the work of second-rate artists, and that didn't win him any friends. It made him a villain. An artist's ego is a precious thing. People like Cal Halapay and Franz Bookwalter, or Mrs. Bookwalter, to be exact, did a lot of talking about my husband at the club, and it wasn't nice. That's why Earl would never go to the Turp and Chisel.
So far, said Quillerin, you've mentioned only outsiders who were unfriendly. Was there anyone within the organization who didn't get along with your husband?
Zoe hesitated. She looked apologetic. Nobody really warmed up to him. He had an aloof manner. It was only a facade, but few people understood that.
There's the possibility that the crime was committed by someone who had a key to the gallery or was willingly admitted to the premises.
That's what Butchie said.
Did anyone but you have a key?
No,
said Zoe, groping in the depths of her handbag.
Quillerin said, Can I get you something?
Maybe I'll have a glass of water with some ice. It's rather warm.
He turned down the flame in the fireplace and brought Zoe a drink of ice water.
Tell me about your friend Butchie. I understand she's a sculptor.
Yes, welded metal,
Zoe said in a bleak voice.
You mean she uses a torch and all that?
It might make a story. Lady welders are always good for some space, with a photograph of sparks flying. Zoe nodded slowly as she considered the idea.
Yes, I wish you would write something about Butchie. It would do her a lot of good psychologically. Not long ago she lost a $50,000 commission, and it was a damaging setback. You see, she teaches at Penniman School, and the commission would have enhanced her prestige.
How did she lose out?
Butchie was being considered to do the outdoor sculptor for a new shopping center. Then suddenly the commission was awarded to Ben Riggs, who shows at the Lambreth Gallery.
Was the switch justified?
Oh, yes, Riggs is a much better artist. He works in clay and casts in bronze, but it was a blow to Butchie. I'd like to do something to help her. Would you write her up for the paper?
She's a good friend of yours?
Quillerin was comparing the soft, attractive Zoe with the mannish character who had been guarding her on the night of the murder.
Yes and no. We grew up together and went to art school at the same time, and Butchie was my best friend when we were both at the tomboy age. But Butchie never outgrew that stage. She was always big and husky for a girl, and she bluffed it off by acting boyish. I feel sorry for Butchie. We don't have much in common anymore, except old times.
How did she happen to be at your house Wednesday night?
She was the only one I could think to call. After finding Earl and notifying the police, I was in a daze. I didn't know what to do. I needed someone. And so I called Butchie. She came right away and drove me home and said she'd stay with me for a few days. Now I can't get rid of her.
How come?
She enjoys being my protector. She needs to feel needed. Butchie doesn't have many friends, and she has an annoying way of clutching at the few she has.
What did your husband think of her?
He didn't like her at all.
Earl wanted me to drop Butchie, but it's hard to break off with someone you've known all your life, especially when your paths are crossing all the time.
I don't know why I'm telling you these personal details. I must be boring you.
Not at all.
I needed to talk to someone who's disinterested and sympathetic. You're very easy to talk to. Is that typical of newspaper men?
We're good listeners.
I feel much better now, thanks to you.
Zoe leaned back in her chair and was silent, and a tenderness crept into her face. Quillerin smoothed his mustache with the stem of his pipe and beamed inwardly. He said, I'm glad I could...
Are you looking for material for your column?
Zoe interrupted, the radiance of her expression seeming inappropriate for the question. Of course, I'm always...
I'd like to tell you about Nino.
She pronounced the name Nino. Who's Nino? Said Quillerin, camouflaging a mild disappointment with a brisk tone.
He's a thingist. Some people call him a junk sculptor. He makes meaningful constructions out of junk and calls them things.
I saw them at the gallery. One was a piece of sewer pipe stuck with bicycle spokes.
Zoe gave him a luminous smile. That's thing number 17, isn't it eloquent? It affirms life while repudiating the pseudo-world around us. Weren't you gripped by its rebellious tensions?
To tell you the truth, no, said Quillerin, a trifle peevishly. It looked like a piece of sewer pipe and some bicycle spokes. Zoe gave him a sweet look in which reproach mingled with pity.
Your eye isn't tuned to contemporary expression as yet, but you'll develop appreciation in time.
Quillerin squirmed and scowled down at his mustache. Enthusiastically, Zoe went on.
Nino is my protege, more or less. I discovered him. This city has some talented artists, but I can honestly say that Nino has more than talent. He has genius. You should visit his studio.
She leaned forward eagerly.
Would you like to meet Nino? I'm sure he'd make good material for a story.
What's his full name?
9024683, she said. Or maybe it's 5. I can never remember the last digit. We call him 90 for short.
You mean he has a number instead of a name?
90 is a disaffiliate, she explained. He doesn't subscribe to the conventions of ordinary society.
He wears a beard, of course.
Yes, he does. How did you know? He even speaks a language of his own, but we don't expect conformity of a genius, do we? Using a number instead of a name is part of his protest. I think only his mother and the Social Security people know his real name.
Quillerin stared at her. Where does this character hang out?
He lives and works in an alley garage at 12th and Summers, behind an iron foundry. His studio may shock you.
I don't think I shock easily.
I mean, you may be disturbed by his collection of found objects.
Junk?
It isn't all junk. He has a few very fine things. Heaven knows where he gets them. But mostly it's junk, beautiful junk. Nino's talent for alley picking amounts to a divine gift. If you go to see him, try to understand the nature of his artistic vision. He sees beauty where others see only trash and filth.
Quillerin studied Zoe with fascination. Her quiet animation, her obvious conviction. He didn't understand what she was talking about, but he enjoyed being under her spell.
I think you're like Nino, she went on. He is elemental and real, and sad in a way, or perhaps you and I are the sad ones, conducting ourselves according to a prescribed pattern. It's like following the steps of a dance composed by a dictatorial dancing master. The dance of life should be created from moment to moment, with individuality and spontaneity.
Quillerin roused himself from a rapt stare and said, "May I ask you a personal question? Why do you paint such incomprehensible things when you have the ability to make real pictures of real things?" Zoe gazed at him sweetly again.
"You are so naive, Mr. Quillerin, but you are honest, and that is refreshing. Real pictures of real things can be done by a camera. I paint in the exploratory spirit of today. We don't have all the answers, and we know it. Sometimes I'm bewildered by my own creations, but they are my artistic response to life as I see it today. True art is always an expression of its time."
"I see." He wanted to be convinced, but he wasn't sure that Zoe had succeeded.
"Someday we must discuss this subject at great length."
There was an unaccountable yearning in her expression. "I'd enjoy that," he said softly. A self-conscious silence loomed between them. Quillerin breached it by offering her a cigarette.
"I've given them up," she reminded him.
"Cookie, they're chocolate chip."
"No, thanks," she sighed.
He pointed to the Monet over the fireplace. "What do you think of that? It came with the apartment."
"If it were a good one, Mont Clemens wouldn't squander it on a tenant," she said with an abrupt edge to her voice, and her quick change of mood astonished Quillerin.
"But it has a nice frame," he said. "Who makes the frames at the Lambreth Gallery?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Just curious. People have remarked about their fine workmanship."
It was a lie, but the kind of lie that always elicited confidences. "Oh, well, I might as well tell you. It was Earl. He made all the frames himself, although he never wanted it known. It would have destroyed the prestige image of the gallery."
"He was a hard worker, making frames, keeping the books, tending shop."
"Yes. The last time I saw him alive, he was complaining about the workload."
"Why didn't he hire help?" Zoe shrugged and shook her head. It was an unsatisfactory answer, but Quillerin let it pass. He said, "Have you remembered anything that might help the investigation? Anything your husband said when you were there at 5:30?
"Nothing of any importance. Earl showed me some graphics that had just come in, and I told him..."
She stopped abruptly.
"Yes. There was a phone call."
"Anything unusual about that?"
"I wasn't listening particularly, but there was something Earl said, now that I remember it, that doesn't make sense. It was about the station wagon."
"Did your husband have a wagon?"
"Every dealer has to have one. I hate them."
"What did he say about the wagon?"
"I wasn't paying too much attention, but I heard something about putting paintings in the station wagon for delivery. Earl said the wagon was in the alley. In fact, he repeated it rather emphatically. That's why it comes to mind. I didn't think of it at the time, but now it seems strange."
"Why does it strike you as strange?"
"Our car was at the repair shop having a tune-up. It's still there. I never picked it up. Earl had dropped it off at the garage that morning, and yet he was insisting on the telephone that it was in the alley, as if the other party was giving him an argument."
"Do you know who was on the line?" Quillerin asked.
"No, it sounded like long distance. You know how people shout when it's long distance? Even when it's a perfectly good connection, they think they have to pitch their voices higher."
"Maybe your husband was telling a little white lie for business reasons."
"I don't know."
"Or maybe he was referring to some other dealer's station wagon."
"I really don't know."
"You didn't see anything parked in the alley?"
"No, I went in the front door and left the same way, and when I went back at 7 o'clock, there was no car of any kind in the alley. Do you think the phone call has any bearing on what happened?"
"It wouldn't hurt to tell the police about it. Try to remember as much as you can." Zoe lapsed into a reverie. "By the way," Quillerin said, "does Mount Clemens have a car?"
"No," she murmured.
Quillerin took a long time to refill his pipe, tapping it noisily on the ashtray. As if in answer to his signal, there was a prolonged, desolate wail outside the apartment door.
"That's Coco," said Quillerin. "He objects to being excluded. Mind if he comes in?"
"Oh, I adore Cao Cocoong."
Quillerin opened the door, and the cat, after his usual reconnaissance, walked in, his tail moving from side to side in graceful arabesques. He had been sleeping and had not yet limbered his muscles. Now he arched his back in a taut curve, after which he extended two forward legs in a luxurious stretch. He concluded by making a long leg to the rear.
So he said, "He limbers up like a dancer."
"You want to see him dance?" said Quillerin. He folded a piece of paper and tied it to a string. In anticipation, Coco took a few small steps to the left and a few to the right, then rose on his hind feet as the bauble started to swing. He was all grace and rhythm, dancing on his points, leaping, executing incredible acrobatic feats in midair, landing lightly and leaping again higher than before. Zoe said,
"I've never seen him perform like that. Such elevation, he's a real Nijinsky."
"Mount Clemens stresses intellectual pursuits," Quillerin said, "and this cat has spent too much time on the bookshelves. I hope to broaden his range of interests. He needs more athletics."
"I'd like to make some sketches." She dived into her handbag. "He does a grand battement just like a ballet dancer." "A ballet dancer. A ballet dancer." The words brought a picture to Quillerin's mind. A cluttered office, a painting hung crookedly on the wall. The second time he had seen that office, over a patrolman's shoulder there was a body on the floor. And where was the painting? Quillerin could not remember seeing the ballet dancer. He said to Zoe, "There was a painting of a ballet dancer at the Lambeth Gallery. Earl's famous Girotto,"
she said as she sketched rapidly on a pad. "It was only half of the original canvas, you know. It was his one great ambition to find the other half. It would have made him rich, he thought." Quillerin was alerted. How rich? If the two halves were joined and properly restored, the painting would probably be worth $150,000. The newsman blew astonishment through his mustache. "There's a monkey on the other half," she said. "Girotto painted ballerinas or monkeys during his celebrated vibrato period, but only once did he paint both dancer and monkey in the same composition. It was a unique piece, a collector's dream. And after the war it was shipped to a New York dealer and damaged in transit, ripped down the middle. Because of the way the picture was composed, the importer was able to frame the two halves and sell them separately. Earl bought the half with the dancer and hoped to trace the half with the monkey." Quillerin said, "Do you suppose the owner of the monkey has been trying to trace the ballet dancer?"
"Could be. Earl's half is the valuable one. It has the artist's signature."
As she talked, her pencil skimmed over the paper and her glance darted between sketch pad and performing cat. "Did many people know about the Girotto?"
"Oh, it was quite a conversation piece. Several people wanted to buy the ballerina just on speculation. Earl could have sold it and made a nice little profit, but he was holding out for his dream of $150,000. He never gave up hope of finding the monkey."
Quillerin proceeded circumspectly. "Did you see the ballerina on the night of the crime?" Zoe laid down her pencil and pad.
"I'm afraid I didn't see much of anything that night."
"I was there snooping around," Quillerin said, "and I'm pretty sure the painting was gone."
"Gone?"
"It had been hanging over the desk on my previous visit, and now I remember, the night the police were there, that wall was vacant."
"What should I do?"
"Better tell the police. It looks as if the painting's been stolen. Tell them about the phone call, too. When you get home, call the Homicide Bureau. Do you remember the detectives' names? Hames and Wojcik?" Zoe clapped both hands to her face in dismay.
"Honestly, I had forgotten all about that Girotto."
This ends Disc 3.